If you would open up to Matthew chapter 10, Matthew chapter 10. If you remember, as we finished out chapter 9, the book of Matthew, I hope you've enjoyed our study up to this point. Of course, we'll continue it with today being the last class. We'll continue that in September when we gather back together. As the Gospel of Matthew is really unfolded, by the time Jesus is baptized in Matthew chapter 3, then you come to chapter 4 and you really get the first real glimpse about Jesus in public ministry. Chapters 5, 6, and 7 are the Sermon on the Mount about Jesus' teachings. And then you get Matthew's chapters 8 and 9 about, now you really see how what Jesus is doing and his power and authority that he's showing among mankind. And so really, when you boil all that down, you really only have three chapters of the ministry of Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, chapter 8, and chapter 9. You have Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthews 5, 6, and 7. And so you really haven't come to know Jesus super well yet. I mean, he's opening the doors up on a lot of things, but there's so much more of what he's going to do. And as part of this, he looks at the end of chapter 9, and he sees these people and he has compassion for them. He says, because they're distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. There's no one to care for them. And because the sheep have not yet come to Jesus as the shepherd, look at what it's left them as. And he uses these words about being distressed. And we talked about this is like a bowstring that's gone loose. There's no strength to do something. This is very feeble. And then he talks about dispirited. Think about to be cast down and to go, what can you do on your own as a sheep that doesn't have a shepherd to prop you back up and to make sure that you're fed and to make sure that you're taken care of when disease comes? All of those things. And so here's a people without a shepherd. And Jesus knows why they're in this situation. And whenever he sees that, it draws inside of him a compassion. And realize compassion is not a mere emotion. Compassion is the trigger moment. Whenever you go, when there's true compassion, like in the New Testament, it means something is about to be done. There's going to be a reaction to this or a movement toward what's going to happen next. You don't just look at somebody in a bad situation and say, boy, I have compassion for you, and then walk away. Compassion is a trigger moment about something is about to take place. You can always look for it. Then, verse 37 in chapter 9 says, then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Anybody in here grow up on a farm or around a farm? Some of you? If you've ever come to the point where all of a sudden you look out into the fields, whether no matter what you grew, if it was a vegetable garden or if it was rows of crops, you see all that needs to be taken in terms of the fruit is on the vine, is on the plant, is on the vegetation. What is it going to take to bring all this in? And I think about driving through the South in certain months out of the year, when all of a sudden you look out from the highway and you see cotton on all these humongous acres that's pretty well flat, and to go, what would it take to pull all that in by hand? And there are some people who know that by experience. But to go, here is what's in front of us. The harvest is plentiful. He says, but the workers are few. He says, there's going to be a work here. This is not just going to happen in and of itself. Then, verse 38, here's the response. Notice he doesn't tell them immediately, okay, boys, it's time to put your hands in and get dirty. He says, here's the response when you see that the harvest is plentiful, but there aren't very many workers. Verse 38 says, therefore beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest. He says, he doesn't say talk to the workers. He says beseech who? The Lord of the harvest. Because he stands in control. And the workers have to work under his guidance, under his lead, under his direction. In Matthew chapter 10, which we're certainly not going to cover all of today, we've come kind of to chapter 10 as a break. And chapter 10 as a whole, all the way from verse 1 down to verse 42, is all about the instruction that Jesus is going to give to his laborers, his workers, which is going to be these 12 men in particular that he's going to list. But I want you to notice that that's exactly what chapter 10 is. It's Jesus' instruction to his laborers, his workers. Now, you might say, well, how do you really know that? Well, look at chapter 11 and look at verse 1. Matthew 11, verse 1. When Jesus had finished giving instruction to his 12 disciples, he departed from there to teach and preach in their cities. So what do you know all of chapter 10 is? It's the instruction. And so I wonder how often those who are getting ready to be sent out, maybe on a mission trip, maybe in terms of what's going on. And some of these things you'll see are not going to be the same after Jesus' resurrection. There's going to be a couple of things in here that are going to be different. But just in generality to go, you need to understand these principles. And you need to understand your part in this. So, looking back at Matthew chapter 10, look at verse 1. Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Now notice, how many in particular is he summoning? 12. Now understand, there's far more disciples than 12. But these 12 are being summoned to himself. There's a parallel of this in Luke chapter 6, which tells you a little bit more intimate detail. Before Jesus calls them, Jesus literally spends the whole night in prayer. Praying the whole night before he's going to call these 12 men. And that's quite something because it's the only time that it gives you that type of detail about Jesus in his whole life. That he spent the whole night praying. Now we think of other instances later on in the garden. We think of instances when he's out in the wilderness that he's praying. But this is the moment that he prays all night before he does this. And I remember one time in college, I was asked by a missionary to put together a team to go and do a certain work. And he says, you know, if it doesn't come together, it doesn't come together. If it does, it does. And I remember for the first time having to go through and think about that. Who do you really want to go? And then quickly you realize, we're all weak. There are certain things we're not good at. There are certain things that we're wonderful at. And to realize how difficult of a time that is. Especially when you realize these 12 are going to be used in a marvelous way, not just in the short term. But we're talking about eventually they're going to cover all humanity in that time. Colossians 1 points it out that the message of the gospel is going to be taken, had been taken, by the time of the writing of the book of Colossians, had already been taken to every soul under heaven. And to think, you're having to sit down and choose the 12. Now, here's Jesus. He summoned his 12 disciples, and notice what does he give them? Authority. The only person who can give authority is one who has authority. And what has Jesus been showing all along through the Gospel of Matthew? What does he have? He has authority. It's specifically pointed out he has authority over sin to forgive. Remember the story of the paralytic who's let down? He has the authority over demons and unclean spirits. He has the authority over sicknesses and disease. He has the authority over death. He has the authority over creation. If you think about the storms, on the storm on the sea that he calms to become perfectly calm. All of these things you see over and over again. And then now you see the only one who can give authority is the one who has authority. Now, once again, I want you to take special note. Gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out. And then at the end of verse 1, he says, and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Have we heard that before? Look back at chapter 9 and look at verse 35. Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Look back at Matthew chapter 4. Look at verse 23. Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. So, in chapter 10, when Jesus gives them this authority, is it something they have seen Jesus do? Yes. And you think, what is a great way to learn how things are done? To be an observer first, right? But then the even better way to learn is learn by doing. Now here's the thing. Jesus gives them this authority. Have you noticed that Jesus never draws attention to himself in these things? Whenever he's going to raise Jairus' daughter from the dead, does he call everybody into the room? In all actuality, what does he do? He sends them away. Whenever he heals the leper back in chapter 9, you know, he tells them, just go to the temple and offer up the offering. For the centurion, just say the word. He says, my servant will be healed. And Jesus just says the word and he goes on. All these kind of things, dealing with sicknesses, dealing with diseases. And so you'll see another aspect that we'll bring up about raising from the dead here in a minute. But notice, they've observed Jesus. They've observed his spirit and how he did it. They've observed his humility and what he's doing. And now that's given over. He says, I give you this authority over every sickness and every disease. So here you are coming up. Notice he doesn't say, now there's going to be a couple of them. He says, look, all of them. And realize, what's the spiritual state of these 12 men at this point? Are they spiritually strong or are they spiritually weak? Very weak. And usually how do weak people handle when they're given authority? Usually, there's going to be some real bumpy spots, right? Or some pitfalls, maybe would be the term. But, without saying any more, look at verse 2. Now, the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. Now, all right, I'll give you a little test. Notice in verse 2, the names of the 12 apostles are these. If you had to guess, how many times do you think the term apostle or apostles shows up in the book of Matthew? This is it. In the Gospel of Matthew, the term apostle only shows up once. In the Gospel of Mark, the term apostle only shows up once. In the Gospel of John, it shows up none. Now, in the Gospel of Luke, it shows up 6 times. When you get to the book of Acts, apostle is going to show up dozens of times. Multiple dozens. So realize, here's this term that's being used. Now, what does apostle literally mean? Well, not necessarily called out. Sent out. People, you know, sent out. Now, what are these men being sent out with? Authority. Now, here they are. And, of course, he gives the names. And we'll learn it later on through the other gospel accounts specifically pointed out. Out of these 12, how are they going to be sent out numerically? They're sent out in pairs. And what's so unique about the Gospel of Matthew is he tells you them in pair order. Look at the way they're listed. You see how they're all listed in couples? Because he says, the first apostle, preeminent, you can use that word, He says, the first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, semicolon. And James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. So it's interesting. Peter and Andrew go out as a pair. James and John go out as a pair. Verse 3, who's Philip's pairing with? Bartholomew. Who's Thomas paired together with? Matthew, the tax collector, who just so happens to be the writer of this account. Right? He says, and then next, James, the son of Alphaeus, who's his pair? Thaddeus. And then Simon the Zealot. Boy, you talk about an interesting pairing. Who's he put together with? Judas Iscariot. And specifically, what does Matthew want you to already know from the moment you meet Judas? He's going to betray him. Almost like, go ahead and keep an eye out for this. And perhaps even, you already know this detail, and you need to know that this is one and the same. Now, I really appreciate how Matthew does that, because not all the gospel accounts do that, to point it out. The way they're listed, I mean, that's just what it comes down to. And knowing that they're going to be sent out in pairs. So otherwise, it doesn't make sense to list them that way. So, if you take really close account here, don't expect through the rest of the book for Matthew to point out, now, this is just the apostles who do this. Notice, Matthew's point is not to say, I want you to know that I'm an apostle and I'm going to keep on nailing that thing down for you. He says, look, these are the 12. These are the 12 that are going to be sent out with a specific mission and goals. And at the same time to go, and we were sent off in pairs, and to say, and that's enough to say about that for now. And really, that terminology is not going to come up again until you get to the book of Acts, if you have access to that in the first century. So here they are, a few more little things to consider. When you look at verse 2, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, what do you know about those four? Just from the other things that you know. All right, their trade is all the same. They're all fishermen. What else do you know? Okay, they're from the same general area around the Sea of Galilee. All right, you know, Peter and Andrew are brothers. James and John are brothers. And not only are two sets of brothers, they're also business partners. If you remember in the fishing story that's in Luke chapter 5, it talks about whenever they caught all these fish, because Jesus told them, hey, cast your nets on this other side. And of course, Peter makes this statement, you know, we've been fishing all night long and we haven't caught anything, as if to say, I'm going to obey you, but I want you to know this little detail. And then whenever they catch so many fish, they have to call their partners over to help them. And it talks about James and John being their partners in this fishing business. Then, so you get a little detail, and in your thinking, you know, were fishermen known as great religious scholars? No, not at all. Not at all. Then, you notice what else is here in verse 3. Now we get to some other things that come together. It says, Philip and Bartholomew. There's a few other stories about Philip that he gets brought up by name, specifically in the Gospel of John. Bartholomew is kind of an interesting little thing to me. I want to believe it, but I don't know if I should. Bartholomew, if you know in terms of how these names work, when you have B-A-R on the front of something, it just tells you who their father is. Like, do you remember the man who's born blind? His name is Bartimaeus. He's literally just the son of Timaeus. Well, this is Bartholomew. And Tholomew, in the Greek language, literally means the farmer or the plowman. It literally means the plowman. And so you go, here he is, Bartholomew. This is the son of the plowman, which kind of wants to make me think, and this is where I have to be really careful because it doesn't say this, but it makes me want to think that Bartholomew is a farmer or he was raised on a farm. And you think about how many things are agricultural through the Gospel of Matthew. The parable of the wheat and tares. The parable of the sower. It tells things about vines and vineyards. And to go, if you're a farmer, you would know these things even more so in an agricultural setting. Like that. Be careful with that one. That's just what his name means. Not every name is very fitting. I'm sure you've met people named Grace and Joy, and you're like, that's the most depressed person I've ever seen, and they are so vengeful. But nobody in here, that's right. So you start to see, that's why I say just be careful with that. But you see, Philip and Bartholomew go together. Then next comes up Thomas and Matthew the tax collector. Oh, this makes me sigh. Seems like Thomas is known more so for the one moment where he was not present with the other ten after the resurrection of Jesus, and they would have doubted it just as much if they hadn't seen Jesus. But, you know, Thomas kind of gets monikered that way as being the doubter, which it just makes me growl a little bit. But the other part that people don't seem to bring up in John chapter 11, that Thomas is really the one who, whenever they're going to go down to where Lazarus is and has died, he says, Jesus is going to go. It's like, last time we were there, they weren't trying to kill you. And Jesus says, well, we're going to go, basically. And Thomas is the one who says, we're going to go with you. Which is, we're going to die with you. Which is really something. Why people don't remember that detail as much. Come on. But some people just like to bring up the bad stuff. Now, we'll get to Judas here in a minute. Stick back with me in verse 3. So, you got Thomas and Matthew the tax collector. Now, once again, the writer of the Gospel of Matthew, specifically to see, here's a guy who makes his living off of the taxes. In terms of that, maybe you don't understand this or haven't heard it, but typically what would happen, I'm going to use kind of our own geography for a moment. If you imagine a tax collector was sold for a certain price, the amount to gather up taxes for, say, let's just say like Cole County. And so he has to divide out, all right, how much does everybody need to pay? And you can understand when you deal with enough households and individuals, you can skim a little bit for yourself. And that's what the tax collector is really known for. It doesn't say that's what Matthew was doing. But that was the assumption among many tax collectors, that they took in a little extra. And they were to make their wage from it. But some people were making a hefty wage. And so realize that. But Matthew definitely has an allegiance in terms of job-wise to the Roman Empire. So understand that. He's very much a government worker, if you want to put it into our terms. And then the next pairing comes up, and you go, well, let's deal with Matthew in another detail. Look over at Mark chapter 2. I want you to see this little detail. Mark chapter 2, and look at verse 14. Because if you notice, there's only a few of these apostles that get a little detail after their description there in Matthew 10. But here in Mark chapter 2, look down at verse 14. Talking about Jesus. As he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth. And he said to him, follow me. And he got up and followed him. Anybody have a little heading above this verse? Some called him Levi, some called him Matthew. I mean, I can understand that. Some people call me Kerry Terry. Some people call me CT. Some people call me Hey You. But you realize there are times we all have multiple names, right? And so for Matthew, here he is. But notice the little detail that it gives you about Levi. Who's he the son of? Alphaeus. Now, come back over to Matthew chapter 10. In verse 3, it says, Philip and Bartholomew, there's a pair, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, and also known as Levi, And he's the son of Alphaeus. And then look at the next pair. James, the son of Alphaeus. Oh, it's possible. And I'm going to say possible. I'm not ready to risk anything on this. I mean, there can be two men who are the son of Jacob, but that doesn't make them brothers, right? And some names are more common than others. But there is a possibility there's a third set of brothers among these 12. Just hang that back there in the recesses of your mind, but to forget later. But I just want to point out that it does bring up those details to where you would be able to kind of put pieces together if they're supposed to be there. And then it brings up, too, about James, the son of Alphaeus. All right, I'll bring it up. Look over at the Gospel of Mark. Look at Mark chapter 15. This one's going to take a second. Mark chapter 15. Look down at verse 40. Of course, Jesus has just died. The centurion has made his statement. Truly, this man was the Son of God. Boy, that must have really ruffled a lot of feathers of those Jews who had just had him killed. But, verse 40. There were also some women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James the Less and Joseph. Joseph is another man's name. So in other words, this Mary, the mother of James the Less and Joseph, he says, and a woman by the name of Salome. This is the only time that James the Less, you find that phrase in all of Scripture. One and only time. And so here it is talking about Mary, the mother of James the Less, and Joseph. Kick back to Mark chapter 6. And let's learn another detail. Mark chapter 6, look at verse 3. Jesus come to his own hometown of Nazareth. It's the Sabbath day. They've come to the synagogue. And Jesus is performing miracles. Verse 3, the people are starting to wonder, who is this guy? Look at what they say. Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? So you realize James the Less is not an apostle. James the Less is the brother of who? Or half-brother of who? Jesus. So oftentimes when people think about the apostles, they think about James the Less. But to go, James the Less is not an apostle. He's the half-brother of Jesus. And so whenever you read over there where we were in Mark chapter 15, who's the Mary that's with Mary Magdalene and Salome? That's Jesus' own mother, right? And so, and by the way, it brings up here, and Judas, the same Jude who wrote the book of Jude. That's how he introduces himself in the very first verse, right? You remember that? Should we go read it? Let's go read it. Look at the book of Jude, right before Revelation. And notice how Jude introduces himself in the book. Jude, the very first verse. Jude 1:1. There's only one chapter to look at, so. I never know whether to say chapter 1 or not when it's just a one chapter book. I apologize. Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James. Notice he doesn't introduce himself as, I'm the half-brother of Jesus. He says, you shouldn't look up to me for that. He says, but you can know who I am. You know who my brother James is. And so you understand that this is how he introduces himself. He says, to those who are the called, beloved in God the Father and kept for Jesus Christ. So, come back to Matthew chapter 10. So if you're wondering, why have we chased all these rabbits down? I want you to make sure that you have a clear picture of who these men are. And specifically here in verse 3, where he says, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, also known as Levi the son of Alphaeus. But he's not linked with his brother in pairing, if they are brothers. He says, James the son of Alphaeus. And this is not James the less. Just make sure of that. That's kind of a misconception that so many have. James the less is James the half-brother of Jesus. Can you understand why he would say that? It's really a title of humility, of saying, look, I'm James the less. Don't think anything more of me. Some people think maybe it's because he was a short guy, but hey, whatever. Karen. You enjoy that all summer long, Karen. Who's the James who wrote the book of James? I'll leave that with y'all. Come back in September and have a good answer for us, Karen. Now, back to Matthew chapter 10. Good question. So, you got James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. And Thaddeus is also known, he has another name, Judas. Can you understand why he goes by a different name? Yeah, I don't want any misconceptions there. And if you want a little note on that, John chapter 14, verse 22, it introduces what he's about to say. And it says Judas, not Iscariot. And they're in the upper room, and it's just the 10 of them, because Judas Iscariot's already left. But it wants to give you that distinction, so just be aware of that. Then, verse 4, Simon the Zealot, what's he so zealous about? It's not for the Lord. I'll give you that one. There was a group of people, they were politically minded, and they were zealous against the Roman government. They did not appreciate the Romans coming down to this Jewish land and leaning their power upon them. So, this is something I want to definitely bring out. Among these 12 men, you have a man by the name of Matthew or Levi the tax collector, who is employed by the government. And then you have another man who is very zealous, by the name of Simon, against the government. Oh boy. You talk about what looks like a powder keg, right? And Jesus spent all night praying about these 12 men to call. Because what did these men need to learn? Is this about political stuff? No. If you let political stuff be a pulse within God's people, what will it do? It'll rip it apart. And to realize, isn't that something Jesus wanted to make sure they knew? Because here it is. Now, here's what's unique. Are there any scriptural stories in the gospel accounts about Simon and Matthew getting into it? Not one. Not one time. Now, you realize, here they are striving to serve Jesus as his apostles. And then, of course, it brings out next, Simon the Zealot gets linked together or paired together with Judas Iscariot. Now, do you know what Iscariot means? It's a term that people use all the time, but very seldom do I think people take the time to really look into it. Iscariot, it's not his last name. Don't think that. Iscariot is the term for where he's from. He's from the city of Kerioth, Kerioth. He's from the city of Kerioth. Do you know what race of people live in Kerioth? Any idea? If you can find the prophet of Amos, I'll show it to you. Look at Amos chapter 2. Uh-oh. Old Testament. Minor prophet. Wouldn't you love to be known as a minor prophet? Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos. Look at Amos chapter 2 and look at verse 2. Actually, look at verse 1. Make sure you get a little context here. Amos chapter 2, verse 1. Thus says the Lord, all caps, covenant God. In other words, you're about to see him make a promise. He says, for three transgressions of Moab and for four, I will not revoke its punishment. Because he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. Now, because of what they have done against Edom, I mean, burned the king all the way down. I mean, incinerated is the idea. And he says, for three transgressions of Moab and for four, I will not revoke its punishment. Is justice coming? Certainly. He says, and because of he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. And if you go back to it, look at verse 2. He says, so I will send fire upon Moab. He says, and it will consume the citadels of Kerioth. And Moab will die amid tumult with war cries and the sound of a trumpet. He says, I will also cut off the judge from her midst and slay all her princes with him, says the Lord. So what do you know about that promise? If God made the promise, what do you know is going to happen? It will happen. Now, that's just a side point. Notice here, Kerioth is a city of what race of people? The Moabites. Now, come back over to Matthew chapter 10. So, whenever you see it talk about Judas Iscariot, I can't tell you that he's a Moabite, but he's definitely raised among people who are Moabites, because that's what that city's known for. That's where that's at. So whenever you see Judas Iscariot, realize it's talking about, look, he's not from Galilee. He's not from Judea. He's not from Samaria. He's from Kerioth. And that's what Iscariot means. And it's made to be a little bit of a delineation to say he was not really like us even in the beginning. Now, this is not to turn up some kind of racial tension, but realize because of being born in Kerioth, which is down in Moab and really far down south, almost toward the Sinai Peninsula, like way down in there, he may have had a skin pigmentation that was a little bit different than the people of Israel. And for whatever tints of dark or lighter that would have been, in the same sense of, you know, people who are born in Scandinavia, or Norway, or Sweden, their skin is typically a lot lighter colored than people who live along the Mediterranean, I mean, the what's that little line? Equator, thank you. In terms of getting down to the equator, going, people's skin is sometimes darker around there. And so just understand what it's bringing out about Judas is specifically to say he's the one who betrayed him. And bringing kind of this mix of details in terms of who Jesus chooses as his 12 to pick men who typically are not considered to be highly educated. Maybe the exception to that by what we know would be Matthew the tax collector. So who is Jesus going to make the treasurer over the group? Judas. Isn't that something? You would typically, don't we typically think along the lines, well, you know, he does accounting, he knows these kind of things, he'd be a better candidate to be the one who's going to be kind of the treasurer for the group. Is that the way Jesus thinks? Is Jesus aware? Certainly he's aware. And so often we need to understand within those who are called out of God, they go, you know, just because I've made a living doing something doesn't mean I'm the one who necessarily should be chosen to do it. And so often that's a realization that we need often. Sometimes you see people, you know, want to bully their way into doing something because of some opportunities they've had earlier in life. And you're going, you know, Jesus doesn't do that. I mean, Judas is the one who's allowed to keep the money. Does Jesus know what Judas is going to do with that? Certainly. Does he know about his love for money? Yes. And you think about what a tough choice to choose one of the 12 who you know is there's going to be one that's going to betray you. I mean, it's written in the Old Testament. And to go, can you imagine making a pick? Who am I going to choose to be the evil one among us? Because there's plenty of times where Jesus says, you all are clean except for one of you. And he's specifically talking about Judas. I realize that would be a tough decision. A tough decision. One that you would want to pray about a lot. And sure enough, what's that? They do, because they're all concerned it might be them. And that's what it actually says over in John. So whenever you see these men, there's one more detail I want you to see. Look over at John chapter 13. And then we'll close out. John chapter 13, we're going to look at verses 15 and 16. This is Jesus in the upper room. Judas is still present. Jesus has just washed the feet of the 12. And now he's going to explain what he's done because they don't know. They don't get it. Nor would we have. But he makes this statement in verse 15. He says, for I give you an example that you also should do as I did to you. He says, I'm going to give you this example. And in doing this, he says, I want you to do as I did to you in terms of the way I've treated you. He says, you've come to know me as Lord and teacher. He says, and this is what I want you to do for others. And that means he's going to have a servant attitude through these things. In other words, saying it wasn't always easy to be around you 12. He didn't say that. But you think about all the stories we know about the 12. I mean, the times whenever James and John come up to him and say, these Samaritans won't let us stay in their town because we're headed to Jerusalem. Do you want us to call down lightning from heaven to destroy them? And they even get a nickname because of it. The Sons of Thunder or Boanerges. You realize, and Jesus says, you don't even know what spirit you're of. You are so not like me. And other times where you have situations that they go through such a growing process in these 3.5 years with Jesus. And it really doesn't all come together until after Jesus' resurrection for them. And that's whenever things start to come together. And then when you get to Acts chapter 2 on Pentecost and the Spirit comes upon them, that's when it all comes together. Now, there's still things that still have to learn. I mean, there's still problems in terms of some other things about accepting the Gentiles and getting to those things. But you understand what they've been through. Now, notice verse 16. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. He says, you need to know this. In whatever you do from this moment forward, and remember, this is the night before Jesus is going to be crucified. He says, you're not going to be greater than me. He says, the slave's not greater than the master. You're going to have to obey, and you're going to have to submit. But then comes this next statement, and I want you to know this because it's easy to miss because of the way the English handles this. Nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. That word for one who is sent, you want to take a guess? Same word for apostle. Who is sending them? Jesus is. I'm sending you out. He says, but you need to know you're not greater than the one who's sending you. Here's another thing for you. In the book of Hebrews, it refers to Jesus as an apostle. Who was Jesus sent by? His Father. God, his Father. And so to realize, he says, I've been an apostle. I've been sent. I know what it's like. But you need to know you're not going to be greater than me. He doesn't say that to put them down. He just says, you need to know the things you've seen me experience, you're going to experience some similar things. And you need to know the way that God has brought me forward, He will take care of you too. And so we're going to kind of leave it at that in terms of the beginning of Matthew chapter 10. When we come back in September, we'll get to the instruction and we'll see what's going to happen there. Hope you all have a great summer. Keep on reading and studying. Grow in the Lord and ask that He may grant it. All right. Have a good one.